Things of the Triple Gem, Theruvan Sadanai. Today's Dhamma session is titled Buddha's Advice on Caring for the Sick. This session is in response to a request from one of our Kalyanamitas on this topic, and we begin by looking at the Upadaka Sutta, and we'll also draw on other teachings, inspiration from good role models, as well as highlighting the benefit of some of the sutta meditations we already practice. So let's begin by paying homage to the Triple Gem. We can bow our heads in Anjali. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dhamma, and homage to the Noble Sangha. The request from one of our Kalyanamitas specifically asked, how can we apply Buddhism or Buddhist teachings for caregivers of people with chronic illness? The Buddha has given a number of teachings to the monks on caring for the sick. As we know from the Buddha's teachings, the Buddha continually emphasized the Four Noble Truths, and particularly with regards to the noble truth of suffering, that with birth, there is aging, sickness, and death, and of course, the whole mass of suffering. When we have the right view as part of developing the Noble Eightfold Path, this means we understand this deeply. Part of our collective or universal predicament in samsara means that we understand this as a truth. All of us, having birthed this body, know that we are subject to aging, sickness, and death. And we all can admit aging is painful, sickness is painful, and death is painful. As we go through this session and look at this topic of being carers to people who are sick or caregivers of loved ones with advanced aging, terminal, or chronic illness, we must keep the right view at the forefront of our minds. It's far too easy to fall down or drown in our personal circumstances or challenges and forget that this is a universal predicament, that we're all in the same boat. If we forget, then we inevitably veer off from the right view and we go down the hate path, resulting in painfulness and pain, dukkha-dukkhita in Pali. If you've forgotten what this means and how this happens, don't worry, we're going to revisit this in this particular Dhamma session today. We also need to remember that a fundamental part of right view is about kamma, so that this means our actions by body, speech, and mind. As we know, the Buddha always says beings are the owners of their kamma, heirs of their kamma, they originate from their kamma, are bound to their kamma, have kamma as their refuge. It is kamma that di distinguishes beings as inferior or superior. As we've highlighted in our session on a deeper contemplation of kamma, and briefly in some other of the sessions, when it comes to sickness and death, or when it comes to sickness and health, the Buddha has said in the Chula Kamma Vibhanga Sutta, this is Majjhima Nikaya Discourse number 135, here, some man or woman is given to injuring beings with the hand, with a club, with a stick, or with a knife. Because of performing and undertaking such action, on the dissolution of the body after death, he reappears in a state of deprivation. But if instead he comes back to the human state, then wherever he is reborn, he is sickly. This is the way that leads to sickliness. Namely, one is given to injuring beings with the hand, with a club, with a stick, or with a knife. But here, some man or woman is not given to injuring beings with the hand, with a club, with a stick, or with a knife. Because of performing and undertaking such action on the dissolution of the body after death, he reappears in a happy destination. But if instead he comes back to the human state, then wherever he is reborn, he is healthy. This is the way that leads to health. Namely, one is not given to injuring beings with the hand, with a club, with a stick, or with a knife. So, when we deal with our patient, loved one, or any person that we see is sick or suffering, we need to include this Buddha knowledge about kamma. Essentially, it is because of past unwholesome kamma or actions a person is sickly rather than healthy. They are the owners of their kamma, heirs of that kamma, bound to that kamma. So this is a very important Dhamma to deeply include and understand. If and when we are caring or caregiving in whatever scenario, it's very important to keep our mind uplifted with the right view, Otherwise, we tend to suffer immensely. If we are able to keep the mind uplifted with right view, then the rest of the Noble Eightfold Path will unfold and align correctly. This is what is important in whatever we do, because we, our loved ones, our community, and everyone else in the world is subject to aging, sickness, and eventually death. The Buddha's wisdom path, this is what helps us to bear with what is inevitable. So the first sutta we can look at is the Dutiya Upatthaka Sutta. This is Anguttara Nikaya chapter 5, discourse number 124. So in this teaching to the bhikkhus, the Buddha made reference to a personal attendant or carer. In Pali, this is Upatthaka. And he stated, "Bhikkhus, possessing five qualities, an attendant or carer is not qualified to take care of a patient. What five? One, he is unable to prepare medicine. Two, he does not know what is beneficial and harmful, so he offers what is harmful and withholds what is beneficial. Three, he takes care of the patient for the sake of material rewards, not with a mind of loving kindness. Four, he is disgusted at having to remove feces, urine, vomit, or spittle. Five, he is unable from time to time to instruct, encourage, inspire, and gladden the patient with the Dhamma talk. Possessing these five qualities, an attendant or carer is not qualified to take care of a patient." And then it goes on to say, possessing these five qualities, an attendant or carer is qualified to take care of a patient. What five? So one, he is able to prepare medicine. Two, he knows what is beneficial and harmful, so he withholds what is harmful and offers what is beneficial. Three, he takes care of the patient with a mind of loving kindness, not for the sake of material rewards. Four, he is not disgusted at having to remove feces, urine, vomit, or spittle. And five, he is able from time to time to instruct, encourage, inspire, and gladden the patient with a Dhamma talk. Possessing these five qualities, an attendant is qualified to take care of a patient. As we can see from this list, things that make one unqualified or qualified as an attendant carer, some are practical qualities, so such as being able to prepare the medicine and offer what is beneficial and withhold what is harmful, while others are more dharmic or spiritual qualities, such as having a mind of loving kindness, not being disgusted with cleaning up after a patient, and being able to share Dhamma with a patient. So if we look at each quality a little more, the first one is able to prepare medicine, is the first quality. Clearly, this is a very important quality. When a patient is sick, they often need to go for treatment or to take medicine. So part of caregiving is helping to ensure that medicine is prepared carefully and properly. The right dosage is administered in accordance with the doctor's instructions. In some cases, depending on the patient and their illness, it can be straightforward. But in many cases, this can be a very involved process requiring effort, diligence, and patience. It's important to acknowledge the amount of giving and giving up that is part of being an attendant or carer. We give our time, our energy, and resources to our patient or loved one. And what we are doing is giving up the time, energy, and resources we would have had for ourselves. So we overcome stinginess by way of giving. So we can recognize this is part of the non-greed path. Depending on what kind of treatment, preparing medicine can include boiling up herbs to make a tonic, maybe mixing certain powders together, or it can be helping with a purgative treatment, or maybe it involves applying certain oils, or going to the hospital with a patient, things like that. What this means is an attendant or carer needs to step up and ensure they are on top of whatever treatment or medicine is needed for the patient. And of course, another part of preparing medicine is associated with food or diet. We've often heard the phrase, "food is medicine." If we understand this, then food preparation can also be included in preparing medicine. And this is linked to the second quality of an attendant or carer, which is knowing what is beneficial and harmful. We withhold what is harmful and offer what is beneficial. With respect to food or diet of our patient or loved one, we would withhold the food and drink that is harmful and offer what is beneficial. So, for example, if our patient is a diabetic, then we would withhold sugar and offer something that is sugar-free or moderate what is beneficial. I mean, what is harmful. Or if a patient is being treated for depression, we may offer foods that are high in fresh fruit and vegetables, cooling foods and drinks, and withhold food that and drinks that cause inflammation. And there are other areas where we may have certain knowledge of what is beneficial or what is harmful to our patient or loved one. It could be about the kinds of visitors who aid recovery versus those who block recovery, or the kind of healing environment versus a more toxic or unhelpful environment, and so on. This can even link to the fifth quality of sharing Dhamma with a patient, which is what is most beneficial. As we can see from looking briefly at these first two qualities, they are very practical qualities that make us qualified to attend or care for our patient or loved one. And we may also choose to do our own research into the nature and treatment of the illness as a way to educate and make ourselves more qualified. And this is the way we offer a practical care and support. So then we come to the third quality of a qualified attendant, which is loving kindness. One takes care of the patient with a mind of loving kindness, not for the sake of material rewards. Here, the Buddha is now getting into the heart of things. When we take care of our patient, a qualified attendant or carer does so with the mind of loving kindness. So let's be clear, being able to take care of a patient with a mind of loving kindness is actually a high practice. This doesn't mean it's something that we cannot do. If anything, we need to recognize the importance of loving kindness and make an effort towards developing it. If we were to reflect honestly, we can sometimes, or maybe oftentimes, be imbued with frustration, impatience, intolerance, aversion, anger, and even hostility towards our patient. And what is the Buddha's antidote for aversion and anger? As we know, it's loving kindness. The encouragement here is to ensure we learn and practice the Karaniya Metta Sutta as the Buddha has given step-by-step instructions on cultivating or developing loving kindness. So I won't go into the detail on the steps because we've had many sessions on this Karaniya Metta Sutta before. But what I will emphasize here is that when we follow the Buddha's instructions, we develop physical, verbal, and mental loving kindness. So in other words, with our physical conduct, we abandon killing. This means we don't poison, murder, or harm our patients. We abandon taking what is not given, so we don't steal our patients' belongings or misuse them. We abandon sexual misconduct, so this means we don't prey on our patients or sexually abuse them in their sickened state. With our verbal conduct, we abandon lying or false speech, so this means we don't lie in order to mislead or cheat our patients for material gain. And we abandon harsh speech, so this means we don't use rude or harsh words, we don't raise our voice out of anger. And then we also abandon divisive speech. So that means we don't slander in order to divide our patients from others. And then we also abandon frivolous speech. So this means we don't gossip or have empty talk that increases delusion in our patients. And with our mental conduct, we abandon wrong view. This means we don't foster the wrong view of me and mine or self. And we abandon ill will, which means we don't wish harm on any living being, including our patients or loved ones. And we abandon covetousness. So this means we don't breed sensual desire and covet for material gain. So most of us are familiar with stories in the news media about harm caused to patients in nursing homes or by their carers or home helpers. Or we're familiar with situations where sick family members or friends have been preyed upon or harmed by others. All of these demonstrate the lack of loving kindness by body, speech, and mind. So, from our perspective, we can often see misconduct in others, and it's good to contemplate, would we like that to happen to us? And the answer, of course, is no. We fear any kind of bad actions directed at us or being subjected to it. So, it's a good idea to turn that around and ask ourselves whether we have had or are having such misconduct by body, speech, and mind. If so, we need to abandon these unskilled states for the skilled states in order to cultivate loving kindness. As we can see, it's largely for material rewards or gain that misconduct happens. And we'll go into this a little bit further along. As we've said before, what is a good way to connect with this is about being able to purify the mind by abandoning mental stains or defilements. And this is a prerequisite for developing loving kindness. Therefore, being able to do some of our meditations that we've looked at before, such as the Vatupama Sutta, so the simile of the cloth, or Anumana Sutta, these are very important. So, some examples of how defilements can arise when we care for a patient. So, we might get frustrated or upset because our patient refuses to continue with medical treatment, or we feel impatient with our patient because we want certain things to be over and done with. And when we have aversion towards our patient's medical team or the treatment that they've decided upon, maybe it's because we have strong views or preferences about these things. So an example could be our strong views regarding modern medicine or traditional medicine or alternative therapies. And we can also experience anger and envy because our patient appears to favor another carer or person. Or we can feel hostile because our patient regularly doesn't listen to our advice. Or we get into constant arguments with our patient or loved one because we have opposing views and there's mental rigidity or stubbornness and the old, I'm right and you're wrong. Or we can feel superior. You're sick because you didn't take proper care of yourself, and I'm not sick because I did all the right things. And so there are many examples. The point is regular cleaning to acknowledge and abandon these mental stains or defilements, or as the Buddha coined it, inner bathing, can be very helpful. If we're able to stop mental misconduct, so these mental defilements, then it can't escalate to verbal and physical misconduct. So the more wholesome and skillful qualities start to manifest. So the other part of what the Buddha says about being a qualified attendant or carer, so we cultivate loving kindness and we don't have expectations for material rewards. So we can now look at this a little more, this particular part of the quality, which is when we take care of our patient, we're not doing it out of expectation to gain. The Buddha is clearly reminding us of the proper way to give. Remember, the practice of giving is part of the non-greed path. When we give, we are giving up what we would have otherwise had for ourselves. If we give our time, energy, and money with an expectation to gain something materially in the future, then we're still following the greed path. So some examples of how this might sound. We may think, if I take care of my parent who is sick now, they'll leave most of their wealth to me and not to my siblings. Or another one is, if I tend to my sick child, they will in turn look after me when I'm elderly and frail. Or if I look after my friend during this sick period, they'll take me out or give me gifts or give gifts to my family when they recover. Or I'll be given an award or something significant by taking care of this very important person. So there's a number of teachings that we can look at. One is the Pathamadana Sutta. This is Anguttara Nikaya, chapter 8, discourse number 31. Here, the Buddha taught the monks that there are 8 ways of giving. And one of the 8 is we give thinking they'll give to me. And when the Buddha was asked by Venerable Sariputta in the Dana Mahapala Sutta about the great giving, this is Anguttara Nikaya, chapter 7, discourse number 52. The Buddha said that the cause and reason why giving, or the question that Venerable Sariputta asked is cause and reason why giving by someone is not of great fruit and benefit, while exactly the same giving by someone else is of great fruit and benefit. Why is that? And in his answer, the Buddha stated, in the case where one gives with expectations, with a bound mind, looking for rewards, it is not of great fruit and benefit. But if one does not give with expectations, with a bound mind, looking for rewards, instead one gives thinking, giving is good, then that is of great fruit and benefit. Whenever the Buddha gave gradual instructions for lay people, he would always start with the talk on giving. Through the Buddha's teachings, we can see the importance of understanding that giving is meritorious, and to give without any expectations or having strong attachment for gain. If we're able to offer assistance and care because it is wholesome, simply because it is wholesome and skillful, then there is less fertile ground for anger to arise because our greed is diminished, because we've abandoned expectations for gain. It's only through greed or sensual desire that we activate ill will, anger, and the hate path. Buddha's wisdom path or inside pathways, jnanapathas, help us to see this. Having right view means we know that giving is good, we accrue merit, and it is a wholesome karma. By giving up greed for material gain, we develop the non-greed path. So this is a very solid foundation for loving kindness to be sustained. And so this is how we can understand this third quality of a qualified attendant or carer. Now, if you're already familiar with the first profitable direction or first doorway to Nibbana, that begins with painful practice with slow realization. This makes a lot of sense, and this can be linked to the fourth quality of a qualified attendant or carer, which is one is not disgusted at having to remove feces, urine, vomit, or spittle. By developing the first profitable direction or painful practice with slow realization, this helps us to overcome the first unprofitable direction, which begins with physical nutriment and going the wrong way due to desire. In other words, painful practice with slow realization, which is dukkhapatipada dandabhinya, helps us to understand the true nature of the body and food. Rather than seeing it through a distorted lens, that it is attractive, fair, or pleasing, through this inside pathway, the Buddha teaches us to see it as it actually is, that it is unattractive, foul, or displeasing. As we've previously discussed and highlighted, this is how we uplift the mind with the right view to correctly contemplate the body. We know this in Pali as Kayanupassana. In one of our more recent Dhamma sessions on the profitable perception of repulsiveness, so this is Asubhasanya in Pali, that has also helped us to connect with this Dhamma. So when we contemplate the 32 body parts in accordance with the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, this is Majjhima Nikaya Discourse number 10, or when we contemplate the body as a boil with 9 wound orifices, such as in the Gandha Sutta, or the Buddha's words on the unattractiveness of the body in the Vijaya Sutta, these are all very penetrative teachings that help us to see this more clearly. So this inside pathway of painful practice with slow realization means we understand the noble truth of suffering deeply because we understand this body. As a result, we can see through the deception and lies and recognize that guarding the sense faculties is wise. So when we train this way, we don't have a post-perception of pleasure or happiness with regard to this body or food because we see it as subject to old age, sickness, and death. And so we're bound to suffering. As a result, it's also not worth taking as me and mine. So for these reasons, we are able to develop immeasurable loving kindness. So armed with this knowledge or insight, we would not be disgusted at having to remove and clean up our patient's feces, urine, vomit, or spittle. Instead, we understand the true nature of the body and realize this is part and parcel of our collective predicament. And this is what makes us a qualified attendant or carer. And when we have developed our practice by following the instructions in the Buddha's teaching, then it flows on into the fifth and most important quality of a qualified attendant or carer, which is one is able from time to time to instruct, encourage, inspire, and gladden the patient or loved one with a Dhamma talk. Why do we say this is the most important quality? It's because sharing Dhamma with our patients or loved ones when they're sick is what is most beneficial to help them ease their suffering and help with repairing, recovering, and healing the body from illness. In the suttas, we have accounts of the Buddha and the Sangha doing exactly this whenever a monk or nun or lay follower was sick. They would instruct, encourage, inspire, and gladden them with a Dhamma talk. On many of those occasions, as the teaching was being given, the sick person would recover from their illness or attain path and fruit. There is also one sutta that is very helpful when it comes to teaching or sharing Dhamma called the Udayi Sutta. This is Anguttara Nikaya, Chapter 5, Discourse number 159. So I'll just read out a little bit about this. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Kosambi in Gosita's Park. Now on that occasion, the Venerable Udayi, surrounded by a large assembly of lay people, was sitting teaching the Dhamma. The Venerable Ananda saw this and approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side and said, Bhante, the Venerable Udayi, surrounded by a large assembly of lay people, is teaching the Dhamma. And the Buddha said, it isn't easy, Ananda, to teach the Dhamma to others. One who teaches the Dhamma to others should first set up five qualities internally. What five? One, having determined, I will give a gradual instruction, one should teach the Dhamma to others. So essentially, this means giving gradual or step-by-step instructions as the Buddha would do. And we know that this is quite important. Two, having determined, I will give a talk as one seeing the method of instruction, one should teach the Dhamma to others. So this means if we are able to see and extract the insight pathway or jnanapatha contained in the Buddha's teachings, this is what we teach and share with others. This is very important because the knowledge and insight pathway is the Buddha's method of instruction. And this is what Buddha praised very, very highly. And then thirdly, having determined, I will give a talk out of compassion. One should teach the Dhamma to others. So when we teach or share Dhamma out of kindness and compassion, having understood our collective predicament and genuinely wanting to help others to find a way out of suffering, alleviating the suffering, we don't share Dhamma to show off or to compete or to increase defilements. That's quite key. And then four, having determined, I will not give a talk while wishing for material gain. One should teach the Dhamma to others. So we don't teach or share Dhamma for material gain or reward. So we've mentioned this earlier in terms of even caring for others, but definitely in terms of sharing Dhamma, we don't do it for material gain or reward, nor for praise and popularity or fame. Number five, having determined, I will give a talk without harming myself or others. One should teach the Dhamma to others. So we don't teach or share Dhamma using it as a weapon or to wound or hurt others, nor to hurt ourselves. So we don't need to be perfect in these internal qualities because we're not actually arahants, but we can reflect on them each time the opportunity arises for us to share Dhamma. So we set up the right conditions internally in our mind before we speak the Dhamma. Now, as carers or caregivers, we may think, oh, we don't know how to share Dhamma, or we don't know that much. But the point here is to share what we know and what we practice, what we have practiced and what we can practice of the Buddha's teachings, basically the sutta meditations that have produced fruit and benefit for us, what we know that has worked for us. In that way, it's authentic and doable. So if you know and practice the simile of the cloth meditation or Vatupama Sutta, then this is what you instruct, encourage, inspire, and gladden them with, or loving kindness as per the Karaniya Metta Sutta, or helping our patient or loved one to understand the true nature of the body, or what we understand of the Four Noble Truths, or whatever other sutta meditations resonate with us. Now, the Buddha also has other accounts that can be helpful to us. And to understand this quality anyway of encouraging and gladdening patient's mind in the Dhamma, it's good to delve into some of these accounts in the Pali Canon that are connected with this of sharing Dhamma to those who are sick. So the first one we can highlight relates to Nakula's parents, who we have examined before in Who Are Our Role Model series. Nakula Mata is the mother and Nakula Pitta is the father. As most of you may recall, Nakula Pitta was gravely sick and he was consoled by Nakula Mata, who told him there was no need to worry if he were to die, as she's well able to support the family and practice the Dhamma. As she counsels Nakula Pitta, she goes through a very comprehensive list of things that he need not worry about, and one can sense a genuine stability in her understanding and practice of Dhamma. and also an equanimity towards the possibility of her husband passing away from his grave illness. Quite remarkable. And while Nakulamata is giving counsel to Nakulapita, as it goes in this particular sutta, the Nakulapita Sutta, his ailment subsided on the spot. He recovered from that grave illness and soon after went to visit the Buddha. And the Buddha said these words to Nakulapita: "It is truly your good fortune and gain, householder, that the housewife Nakulamata has compassion for you, desires your good, and exhorts and instructs you. Nakulamata is one of my white-robed female lay disciples who fulfills virtuous behavior. She is one of my white-robed female lay disciples who obtains internal serenity of the mind. She is one of my white-robed female disciples who have attained a foothold, a firm stand, assurance in this Dhamma and discipline, who have crossed over doubt, gotten rid of bewilderment, attained self-confidence, and become independent of others in the teacher's teaching. It is truly your good fortune and gain, householder, that the housewife Nakulamata has compassion for you, desires your good, and exhorts and instructs you." So we can see how powerful it is when one does encourage, inspire, instruct, and gladden a patient or loved one's mind with Dhamma, with the truth. And then we have the Gilana Sutta. This is from Sanyutta Nikaya, chapter 55, discourse number 54, where Mahanama asked the Buddha, "How does a wise lay follower who is sick, afflicted, and gravely ill, how should they be exhorted by another wise lay follower?" So note that this particular sutta is specific to someone who is a wise lay follower, so the patient or a loved one, not someone who has not taken refuge in the triple gem. So here the Buddha gave a very interesting answer to Mahanama. He said, "A wise lay follower, Mahanama, who is sick, afflicted, and gravely ill, should be consoled by another wise lay follower with four consolations. Let the venerable one be consoled. You have confirmed confidence in the Buddha. Thus, the Blessed One is, etc., etc., teacher of devas and humans, the Enlightened One, the Blessed One." And then the second consolation is, "You have confirmed confidence in the Dhamma." The third one is, "You have confirmed confidence in the Sangha." And the fourth is, "You have virtues dear to the noble ones, unbroken," and so on, leading to concentration. And then, after a wise lay follower who is sick, afflicted, and gravely ill has been consoled by a wise lay follower with these four consolations, the Buddha outlined a series of questions that they should be asked to help them to abandon their remaining attachments. So, attachments to parents, to their spouse and children, to the five cords of sensual pleasures, attachment to the sensual realms, and attachment to the Brahma realms. And this is in order to realize the fruit of arahantship. So this is quite a powerful sutta in the sense that it's a great gift to be able to instruct, encourage, inspire, and gladden our patient or loved one if they are a wise lay follower of the Buddha. Because if they follow the instructions of the Buddha in this particular sutta and we guide them through, then they can attain even arahantship. And so we're talking about someone who is suvacha, easy to instruct, someone who has good qualities, someone who has taken refuge in the Buddha Dhamma and the Sangha, and maintains some kind of virtue dear to the noble ones. So this sutta, the Buddha gives very clear instructions and very sequential instructions, and so we can see can bear great fruit. So this sutta is not suitable for a patient or loved one who hasn't taken refuge in the Buddha, because it wouldn't resonate in the same way and it wouldn't aid them because they don't have that kind of practice. And we've also highlighted in our Bodhanga series, by wisely contemplating the seven factors of enlightenment or Bodhangas, one can recover from illness. So here we're talking about the enlightenment factor of mindfulness, so Satisampojjhanga, enlightenment factor of investigation of Dhamma, so Dhammavicchayasampojjhanga, enlightenment factor of energy, Viriya Sampojjhanga, enlightenment factor of rapture, Pithisampojjhanga, enlightenment factor of tranquility, so Pasadi Sambhujanga, enlightenment factor of concentration, so Samadhi Sambhujanga, enlightenment factor of equanimity, Upeka Sambhujanga. As we already know, there are suttas in the Gilana Vagga, which is the chapter on illness, so Sanyutta Nikaya chapter 46. And this is part of the Bhojanga Sanyuttas, where Venerable Mahakasapa and Venerable Mahamoggallana were sick, and the Buddha taught them the Bhojangas, or reminded them of the Bhojangas, and they were both elated by the teaching and recovered from that illness. And similarly, when the Buddha was sick and Venerable Mahachunda recited the Bhojangas, and the Buddha approved of what he said and recovered from his illness. So if one is skilled at the Bhojangas and is able to give a Dhamma talk or an explanation, then it can be very beneficial to the patient or loved one who is sick. And I know of examples where the Bhojangas have been explained by a wise lay person, and a patient has been able to recover more quickly from surgery. Also, where a patient is suffering from chronic pain, it has been able to alleviate a significant amount of suffering. And where a patient has been able to reduce the intensity of an illness and then recover easily. So we've highlighted in our Bhojanga series the connection between the mind and the body. We know that when the mind is sick, then the body becomes sick. And when the mind is tranquil, the body becomes tranquil. So it's very important to understand this for reducing the conditions for sickness and promoting the conditions for good health. And in particular, we highlighted that the enlightenment factor of tranquility plays an important part in ensuring the mind is purified, that it's not burning with greed, hatred, and delusion. So these are some examples from the suttas that give us some idea about why, as qualified carers or caregivers, we should be able from time to time to instruct, encourage, inspire, and gladden our patient or loved one with a Dhamma talk. Now, taking on the role as a carer or caregiver is only one side of the relationship. So it's a good idea to also briefly look at the role of the patient. There is a significant difference in outcomes for a patient who is difficult to take care of versus one who is easy to take care of. And I think it's important to factor this in when we examine the area of caring for the sick. The Buddha did give a teaching on the qualities of a patient, and it's in the Pathama Upataka Sutta. So this is the sutta just before the one we went through. So the Buddha said, Bhikkhus, possessing five qualities, a patient is difficult to take care of. What five? He does what is harmful. Two, he does not observe moderation in what is beneficial. Three, he does not take his medicine. Four, he does not accurately disclose his symptoms to his kind-hearted attendant or carer. He does not report, as fits the case, that his condition is getting worse or getting better or remaining the same. Five, he cannot patiently endure arisen bodily feelings that are painful, racking, sharp, piercing, harrowing, disagreeable, sapping one's vitality. And of course, the Buddha then says, Bhikkhus, possessing five other qualities, a patient is easy to take care of. What five? He does what is beneficial. Two, he observes moderation in what is beneficial. Three, he takes his medicine. Four, he accurately discloses his symptoms to his kind-hearted attendant or carer. He reports, as fits the case, that his condition is getting worse or getting better or remaining the same. Five, he can patiently endure arisen bodily feelings that are painful, racking, sharp, piercing, harrowing, disagreeable, sapping one's vitality. So we will all come across these two different kinds of patients and even a mix of both. We may also recognize some of these qualities in ourselves as patients. An important thing to realize is that a qualified carer will do well with a patient that is easy to take care of. But even a qualified carer or caregiver will find themselves obstructed, blocked, and constantly challenged if their patient has the qualities of being difficult to take care of. So even if we might withhold what is harmful, our patient still does what is harmful. Even though we might offer what is beneficial, a patient does not observe moderation in what is beneficial. Even though we prepare their medicine, our patient might not take it. And even if we ask, our patient does not accurately disclose their symptoms and whether their condition worsens, improves, or remains the same. And though we tend to them with loving kindness and we're willing to instruct them in the Dhamma, our patient cannot endure what ails them. So such patients can have all sorts of difficult behavior, from denial about their illness and refusal to find out what's wrong, to refusal of medical treatment, to anger and hostility about their situation, to depression and anxiety, and much, much more. In these situations, it's important to not take on more than what is necessary. This is where the Buddha encourages us not to have too much sympathy for the welfare of others. He actually says that it is unwholesome. This doesn't mean we don't offer care and try our best to help, but it does mean that we need to remember to uplift our minds with the right view that we are all brothers and sisters in birth, old age, sickness, and death, and to understand there is karma ripening for the person in our care. Our roles often play a big part in blocking us from the right view. So, for example, a mother caring for her child, and this, it doesn't even matter what age our child could be. And also a child caring for an elderly sick parent, or a husband caring for a wife, or a wife caring for a husband, or a student caring for their teacher or elder, and so on. The weight of that attachment, our personal history with these roles means we can be immersed in me and mine and defilements. If we can be honest with ourselves with regards to these roles and relationships, they can often come with a lot of baggage. He or she did this in the past. He or she favored somebody else. He or she judged me in the past harshly. He or she is a disappointment. He or she failed me in the past. He or she betrayed me. Or whatever the case may be, this baggage can weigh us down. And we can also be immensely swayed by being seen as a good parent or being a good son or good daughter and so on. And this can be according to conventional expectations and the idea of what will people think if I do this or I don't do this, or it can be driven by our own personal expectations. If we identify and cling to our roles and relationships and hold on to them very rigidly, we can suffer more as carers. It's good to know this and to really look at it. In difficult circumstances, it's good to be able to detach oneself. Remember, it doesn't mean we don't care or we want to shirk our caring or caregiving duties. Instead, what we're doing is setting aside our attachment and associated baggage so that higher mind states such as loving kindness, compassion, joy, equanimity can arise, which means less suffering. For example, if we're caring for our elderly and sick father, and we have historically had a difficult relationship with them for whatever reason, then it's good to think of them from time to time as Mr. So-and-so, who is 80 years old with these particular health issues, rather than that's my sick father with all that baggage stemming from childhood and all these personal stories. What it does is help us to disassociate from the role and the baggage that may come with it, the extra weight. On top of that, if they happen to be a difficult patient to take care of, the important thing is to be able to not take it personally. This means we don't take it as me and mine. If we take it personally as that's my sick father and so on and so forth, then we are away from the right view. Our mind is disturbed, it gets sick. And we inevitably suffer immensely, and it impacts on how we care for them. So, with this example, by applying Mr. So and so rather than my father, it can help us to do that. This is why it's easier for a nurse or a doctor to treat patients than for a family member to do so. If a difficult patient rejects medicine given by a nurse, the nurse won't take it personally. They see many patients every day, and a proportion of them might do that constantly. So another nurse comes along and tries to administer it, or they use different means. They see many patients. So, in the sum total of things, it's not meant to be taken personally. It's a job. However, if a father rejects medicine given by their son, the son will likely take that personally. If this father then accepts the medicine from the daughter rather than the son, then you can see all sorts of problems play out in the family, and on it goes. So, from a caregiving perspective, whatever the role relationship scenario is, it's important to remember to create some space. And it's also important that we don't burn ourselves or burn out. When our mind states are weak, we are more prone to falling physically sick. And that is something that isn't helpful. How are we supposed to care for others? How are we useful when that happens? That's why it's wise to have a steady and regular meditation practice to uplift our minds with the right view, to see the importance of making it a priority, and to recognize it as self-care, which will have a wholesome and meaningful impact on those we care for. What we're acknowledging is that if we develop and grow in Dhamma, Buddha Dhamma, this is what makes us more qualified caregivers. So we've previously examined this particular diagram before, and this was to understand objects, contact, and feelings, and we referenced that Aditya Pariyaya Sutta, and the Buddha made reference to three kinds of objects, so agreeable, disagreeable, or neither disagreeable or agreeable, three kinds of sense contact, felt as pleasant, painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, and three kinds of feeling that is pleasant, painful, or neither painful nor pleasant. And what we learned was they all result in dukkha. So painfulness in change, viparinama dukkata in Pali, painfulness in pain, so dukkha dukkata in Pali, and painfulness in construction, sankhara dukkata. And this is also in Pali. So we have previously used this diagram to examine the bigger picture of our collective predicament in samsara. And we can also use it to help us understand the different scenarios that can arise as carers for those with chronic illness and why we suffer, why we experience some kind of dukkha. And the more we understand and shine the light, the more wisdom grows. This will help us to make wiser choices when it comes to the variety of situations we face on an ongoing or recurrent basis. So, if we take the first column, which represents the greed path, we have agreeable object. So, sense contact is felt as pleasant. We get pleasant feeling, and the result is painfulness in change. Then, the second column, which represents the hate path, we have disagreeable object. So, sense contact is felt as painful, and we get painful feeling, and the result is painfulness and pain. And finally, the third column, which represents the hate path, we have neither agreeable nor disagreeable object. So sense contact is felt as neither painful nor pleasant, and we get neither painful nor pleasant feeling, and the result is painfulness in construction. As carers or caregivers of patients or loved ones, we often go down these three columns and experience these three kinds of dukkha. As per usual, to understand this, we need to take some examples. So, in the case of the greed path, the agreeable object could be seeing our patient or loved one doing well after receiving medical treatment, or they're going through a good patch of health and vitality. When we see them, sense contact is felt as pleasant, and so we're happy, pleasant feelings arise. But then, after a period of time, the illness or some symptoms reappear and we feel let down. We might even think, how could this happen? So we experience the painfulness in change. Then it flows into the hate path. Our disagreeable object may be the doctor or doctors who gave us medical advice and thinking that they failed because the patient has had a relapse in the illness. Or maybe it's seeing the decline again in our patient or loved one who is sick, whether it's at a physical, emotional, or mental level. And so when we see them or think about them, sense contact is felt as painful. We suffer with them in this case. We may also feel angry, helpless, frustrated, or painful feelings arise. And so we experience painfulness in pain. Even with the aging of the body and sickness, when we immerse ourselves in it, this is also painfulness in pain. And we can often see our patients going through this as well. Where they usually end up is always with the disagreeable object of their illness all the time. We get sucked into that as carers and caregivers. And so collectively, we end up in painfulness and pain. That's the most common place to abide, but that's not what the Buddha asks us to do. And then we have the third path, which is the delusion path. So alongside our patient or loved one, of course, we would search for new treatments or alternative medicines or other therapies, which becomes our neither agreeable nor disagreeable object. We encourage our patient or loved ones towards one or more treatments, and we become hopeful for the outcome of the treatments. Sense contact is felt as neither painful nor pleasant, and we get neither painful nor pleasant feeling. However, when the treatment doesn't give the medical outcomes we expected or hoped for, or it has minimal effect, or the condition of our patient or sick loved one worsens, or worse than that, then we experience painfulness in construction. What this example demonstrates across these three different pathways is the cycle of suffering that we experience when we don't understand our collective predicament with right view, meaning the noble truth of suffering. So if this is the case, then we can expect to keep repeating the cycle of greed, hatred, and delusion. As carers and caregivers, it's really good to look at this, whether we're looking after a sick patient or sick loved one with chronic illness or a terminal illness or any kind of aging, significant aging or deterioration. The bigger picture is that no matter what object we are attached to and the sense contact and feeling that arises from that, the result can only be suffering. It's a shocking and dire universal predicament. Only by deeply contemplating and understanding the noble truth of suffering, and to really see it as a universal predicament, not just me and my suffering, that all beings are the owners of our karma, and seeing the true nature of the body as being subject to aging, sickness, and death, that is really important to uplift in our mind. We do what we can to alleviate the suffering that arises in this lifetime due to having birthed these bodies. We fulfill our caring duties and responsibilities, but we do need to deeply comprehend that ultimately we do not get what we want for ourselves or even for our patients, our loved ones. What we want is to never age, never get sick, never to die. It's for this reason we and those we care for are bound to this whole mass of suffering. If we understand even a little bit of this Dhamma, it's possible to have more equanimity towards the conditions that ripen for ourselves and for others. And at the same time, we may also feel more compelled towards exploring and penetrating the Buddha's teachings on how to get out of this endless cycle of birth and death and suffering. So we can end our session by looking for some inspiration in the story of Suppiya, who was declared by the Buddha as the foremost of his female lay followers among those who attend on the sick. So this is Gilana Ubbathaka Kinang in Pali. And this is our inspiration and encouragement. So we find her story in the Visuddha Khandaka, which is the chapter on medicines of the monastic rules, the Vinaya. And I'll read out the account. When the Buddha had stayed at Rajagaha for as long as he liked, he set out wandering towards Benares. When he eventually arrived, he stayed in the deer park at Isipatana. At that time in Benares, there were two lay followers, Suppiya and Suppiya, husband and wife, both with confidence in the Buddha. They were donors and benefactors, and they attended on the Sangha. On one occasion, Suppiya went to the monastery. She walked from dwelling to dwelling, from yard to yard, asking the monks, "Is anyone sick? What may I bring?" Just then, a certain monk had drunk a purgative. He told Suppiya about this, adding, "I need meat broth." And then she answered, "No problem, I'll organize it." And so she returned to her house and told a servant, "Go and get some meat." So this is the meat that's for sale in the market. Saying, "Yes, madam," he walked around the whole of Benares but could not find any. So he returned to Suppiya and said, "There's no meat, madam. There's no slaughter today." So Suppiya thought, If that monk doesn't get meat broth, his illness will get worse or he'll die. Because I've already agreed to provide it, it would not be right if I didn't. She then took a knife, cut flesh from her own thigh, and gave it to the slave, saying, "Prepare this meat and give it to the sick monk in such and such a dwelling. If anyone asks for me, tell them I'm sick." She then wrapped her thigh in her upper robe, entered her bedroom, and lay down on the bed. When Supiya returned home, he asked the slave where his wife was. The slave told him. He then went to see her and she told him what had happened. He thought, it's astonishing and amazing how much faith and confidence Supiya has in that she gives up even her own flesh. Is there anything she would not give? Delighted and joyful, he went to the Buddha. He bowed and sat down and said, "Sir, please accept tomorrow's meal from me together with the Sangha of monks." The Buddha consented, but by remaining silent. Knowing that the Buddha consented, Supiya got up from his seat, bowed down, circumambulated the Buddha with his right side toward him, and left. The following morning, Supiya had various kinds of fine foods prepared. He then had the Buddha informed that the meal was ready. The Buddha robed up, took his bowl and robe, and went to Supiya's house, where he sat down on the prepared seat, together with the Sangha of monks. Supiya approached the Buddha and bowed down to him. When the Buddha asked where Supiya was, he replied that she was sick. "Well then, please tell her to come." "She's not able, sir." "Well then, carry her in here." And they did. The moment Supiya saw the Buddha, that great wound healed and was perfectly covered with skin and hairs. Supiya and Supiya exclaimed, "The great power and might of the Buddha is truly astonishing and amazing." Delighted and joyful, they personally served various kinds of fine food to the Sangha of monks, headed by the Buddha. When the Buddha had finished his meal, they sat down to one side. The Buddha instructed, inspired, and gladdened them with the teaching, after which he got up from his seat and left. It's due to this incident that the Buddha laid down the rule forbidding monastics to eat human flesh, even when willingly given. In the case of Supiya, by giving up her own flesh in order to prepare meat broth for the sick monk, she demonstrated a great generosity and a lack of stinginess regarding her dwelling or abode. As we know from our contemplation of the mental stain of stinginess, stinginess regarding our dwelling includes our most precious abode, which is our own body. Supiya has shown she had such a high practice of giving up her own flesh or part of her body. So her sense of self or me and mine is significantly less than ordinary. The pain of giving up her flesh and having a great wound was nothing compared to the happiness of helping the monk. So we need to ask ourselves, would we be able to give up our flesh so easily? Even in our minds, is it possible? And we also know that if we remove stinginess, it's one of the qualities that makes us easy to instruct, Suvicha in Pali, and we're able to develop loving kindness. So Supiya has demonstrated that she has these qualities, having given up her flesh. So we can see why Supiya was swiftly healed from her sickness and declared by the Buddha as foremost among female lay followers who attend on the sick. She's also given it as an example by Venerable Nagasena in his answer to King Milinda of those whose good deeds bore fruit in this very life. Supiya is actually a wonderful role model for us if we are in a caregiving role. She shines the light when it comes to non-stinginess, particularly the absence of stinginess regarding dwelling or abode. So this doesn't mean we have to give up our flesh, but it does mean we need to look at how we can block generosity with five kinds of stinginess. So we are being generous when we are carers and offering caregiving, but there are ways through our own stinginess that we block loving kindness and we block the generosity. And by this, we mean stinginess regarding gain, stinginess regarding dwelling or abode, stinginess regarding families or groups, stinginess regarding our reputation, and stinginess regarding Dhamma. When we value our own happiness above others, then there are so many ways stinginess can kick in. So it's important to be able to identify where this occurs and to abandon it, always to abandon it. Whenever we catch it, we want to abandon it. Whenever we purify the mind, we abandon it. Because then what remains is we're able to be generous, we're able to cultivate loving kindness. So it's good to see stinginess as a mental stain, as a defilement, and see it as unwholesome, that it does not lean towards loving kindness. It's actually a non-metta quality. If we can actually see how we're bound to suffering, then we can also see that it's not worth taking as me and mine. We're able to give up our time, our effort, our service, and whatever wealth we have if it's needed. So in this way, we can more easily develop loving kindness and of course maintain it. So the question that people often ask when we talk about having a mind of loving kindness is, we know for sure that it's not often we're able to activate and maintain it. So these are particular ways, if we do very thorough cleaning, to be very honest, to do it regularly, then it helps us to be able to maintain it. And of course, all the other mental stains as well. So a few final things. I know this is about, particularly about the Dhamma for carers, but when it comes to the patient, there's a couple of things that are worth mentioning. The first one is that when we know that the karma of a patient who is sick is because in the past, their past karma has been unwholesome. They have used their fists or taken a weapon to harm others. And so the result, particularly in this human birth, would be the ripening of that karma. And so therefore, one is sick. Now, a very good thing if a patient is open to Dhamma is to encourage them to offer Abhayadana, so to offer protection to others, to reduce other people's fear. And so that could be helping people to cross the road. It could be saving them if they are being harmed, to ensure that we don't harm others in that way, in accord with that past karma. We don't want to do those things. So we don't take arms, we don't take up weapons, take up a rod, we don't use our fists, we don't harm anyone. So for a patient, that is very, very helpful. Also, as Abhayadana, sometimes it's very good to release animals that are about to be killed or about to be sold at the market. So that's why you hear people when a fisherman has caught a load of fish or seafood, things like that, and you see that happening, then what you do is you quickly, while the fish or seafood is still alive, you buy it off them and you release them back into the ocean. And you don't rationally think, oh, but those things will be caught again. But the idea is that you're saving a life. You're actually protecting. That's the Abhayadana. Sometimes also in certain cultures, they release birds, or they release like birds that are about to be sold, or they release a cow that is about to be slaughtered. So they buy the cow off the person that was going to slaughter it or send it for slaughter. So things like that are very helpful. And the other thing is, often when it comes to patients, they are immersed in, particularly with chronic illness or terminal illness or something that is very dire and has been part of their lives for a very long time. They're often very caught up in me and my suffering, me and my predicament, me and all the stories about what has happened in my health sequence. So from the first time it happened to all the different treatments, to all the doctors and all the different things. And as carers, we can also know all those things as well. But for a patient, what happens is, if all they do is immerse themselves in that, then they don't have the right view or the sense of seeing that they're not the only ones. And of course, rationally, they will say, yeah, I know that there are other people like that. But sometimes they really aren't aware of how introspective they are and how much they go round and round the same thing. So they're actually in that painfulness in pain path, the hate path. And that's where they abide. So it's really helpful for them to actually go out and help other people who are sick. And it doesn't necessarily have to be people who are having the same illness. It could be just going and helping other people who are sick. And it can be small things by just saying, let me buy the medicine for you. Or it could be actually physically helping someone who is sick, who is frail. It could also be going and spending some time as a volunteer, helping people who are sick, who are terminally sick, or things like that. And that can be really, really helpful. And so you step out, you help the patient to step out of their own personal thing. And so, in a mundane way, they start to recognize I'm not the only one. Remember the Buddha said, as one of the reflections, the five frequent contemplations or reflections is when we contemplate about sickness, it's always, I'm not the only one. I'm not the exception. It's everybody is in this predicament. And so sometimes that can be helpful. And of course, with patients or loved ones who are sick, we only offer these things as a way of if they are open to it. And of course, if there is something obstructing them, then we have to be patient if they're not open to these suggestions or advice and things like that. So we've now come to the end of our session. Let's express gratitude to the Buddha for these teachings. Let's also express gratitude to our other teachers, parents, good friends who encourage us on the Noble Eightfold Path. We can now share the merits with all sentient beings. May all beings be happy and well. May all beings be free from suffering. Blessings of the Triple Gem. Wishing you all well. Everyone, Saranai.